This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest is Jonathan Dodson. We're talking about his book, Our Good Crisis, Overcoming Moral Chaos with the Beatitudes. Jonathan, why did you, again, the title of the book was given before the pandemic, but why do you refer to Our Good Crisis?
It's a double entendre, so there's two meanings. There's the fact that there is a crisis of good. We look around us and we wake up to a crisis every day, you know, a Me Too crisis, a political crisis, environmental crisis. There's a lack of goodness in the world, and yet it's a good crisis. In other words, the crisis is an opportunity for goodness, yes. Particularly for those who follow Jesus, who is the embodiment of pure goodness. So it's both a kind of, you know, an assessment of the world we're in and an invitation to change it through the goodness of Jesus.
Let's talk about, we've referred to it once or twice, righteousness. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. And you write, one of my underlines is, living a righteous life ushers in wholeness. It lines up with God issuing a host of virtues, such as humility, purity, mercy, love, and endurance. This is why each beatitude starts with the word blessed. The blessing that ensues from a life of righteousness is the result of living how our Creator intended us to live. He has designed us for flourishing, which happens when we align ourselves with His design. Righteousness is moral goodness that takes its cues from God. This righteousness isn't purely individualistic. It can't contain itself. It spills over into society, touching lives around us. So while righteousness is personally satisfying, it is also socially renewing. And just a little bit later, you write, we can't pick and choose the teachings of Christ we want to keep, nor can we reduce Jesus to the poster child of our pet moralities or political persuasions. Rather, the collective weight of all of Jesus' teachings should drive us to Christ to find forgiveness and power to live moral lives that please God, regardless of how unpopular they may be. We cannot do this alone. And you write that no one can perfectly fulfill this beatitude, much less the entire Sermon on the Mount. So how is it that we should pursue righteousness, especially if we can't do it alone?
So in this chapter, I'm trying to contrast righteousness with values. Values are mushy, and righteousness is firm. So we have values like transparency, kindness. They're kind of subjective. They're kind of mushy. So you might have a company that has those listed on its website, and yet they're doing very unethical things in their business practice. They're not kind to their employees, and they're not transparent about what's really going on. We tend to gravitate to these kind of mushy values in this age rather than the kind of black and white righteousness that the Lord calls us to. And the problem with values is that they're so mushy that they become not only self-serving but unhelpful to others. So in that example, you know, transparent at what level? Well, as long as it's convenient for me. Whereas honesty is tell the truth and tell it all the time. So you've got a value versus a biblical virtue, honesty versus mm-hmm. transparency. And you tell the truth, it might be hard to hear, but it's good for you. It's not self-serving. So as we think about living a righteous life and cultivating this moral goodness that comes from God, the scriptures teach us how to live a righteous life, and there's clear instruction on what is righteous and what is unrighteous. And you know, it's very fashionable to go the value direction. And I'll never forget, we were at a men's retreat, and there's a guy who had just come to Christ probably in the past year, I think it was. And he got up and he shared about living a life pursuing whatever he wanted. He didn't believe in the category of sin. He thought it was silly. He says basically there's just stuff that we like and stuff that we dislike, but there's no real thing such as sin. He lived in an open marriage. He pursued his career, money, and it all came crashing down because the values, the mushy values, we don't flourish in them. A marriage is designed for commitment, commitment in mind, body, soul. You rupture that commitment, and it's not going to work. And so he found out very, you know, devastatingly. And so he came to Christ. He repented, put his faith in Jesus, and he stood up in front of these men at this men's retreat, and he said, "If you don't think morality is real, then come talk to me. Mm-hmm. I can tell you. I'm 55 years old. I lived 54 years thinking sin wasn't real, and I wrecked my entire life." Wow. You know, it was like a personal testimony for righteousness.
Yes.
Like he did it. He lived he lived for himself, and it blew up in his face. And so what we want is to flourish, but we're chasing our own self-made morality when God has handed us a morality in which we actually do find that we flourish.
Some of the other points you make in this particular part of the book is the fact that we've created a moral vacuum, that we need a moral norm to determine what is harmful and what is not, that all of us are prone to replace God with our own vision of justice. What does it mean then to say that we are meant to be righteous together?
Yeah, so righteousness, holiness, godliness, true moral goodness is impossible to cultivate on your own. And the reason for that is, if we just take these Beatitudes, each of the word blessed in each of them is plural. So there's a grammar to support it. Blessed are the poor in spirit. It's for multiple people. But blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is a kingdom of people. It's a kingdom of community. Now, you want to be humble. You want to be merciful. You want to be righteous, the one we're talking about. You need people. you can't be humble without people. Mm-hmm. You can't be meek towards someone and defer to them and serve them and honor them and ask them questions You can't be merciful to forgive and to serve and to love others without other people. And so righteousness is a community project. It's worked out in the push and pull and the friction and the formation of our relationships. And so the only way that we can truly come into step with the design of moral flourishing and human flourishing is if we are doing it with other people. It's meant to spill out into our relationships, and it's in those relationships that we learn to forgive, to serve, make peace in conflict. These hallmarks of the Beatitudes, you just can't do it on your own. It's a community project.
Whenever you get to this point in your book, the Beatitude on Mercy, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. You indicate that you and others might be overwhelmed by the Beatitudes. Why is that? Why would we expect to be? Are they asking too much of us? Why do you think we'd be overwhelmed?
Yes, they are asking too much of us. They're impossible to live on your own. I can't get past the first one. Poor in spirit. It's completely possible. And of course, we've looked at poor in spirit, how it is produced not on your own, but it is produced before the face of God, Coram Deo. And so there is tremendous help for all the Beatitudes. But if you look at them only for the moral guidance that they provide, you're done. I cannot live this life. And of course, the hope of the gospel, and there is a gospel hope attached to each Beatitude, is that there is one who lived them flawlessly on our behalf, not only as a moral example, but also as the one who would complete our humanity, that would be the better Adam, and that would, in his death and resurrection, forgive us and confer upon us that glory, that welcome us into his own righteousness, as we discussed earlier. And so, yes, I mean, anytime I need a good humbling, I just turn to the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes.
And it's so good for my soul. So it does give you that moral direction. But as I mentioned, each one is attached with a heavenly promise. Yours is the kingdom of God. You'll inherit the earth. You will be satisfied. There's these just kind of, you know, heavenly promises. There's a pitchfork, you know, be righteous, be merciful, moral pitchfork, if you will. And then there's this carrot, this heavenly carrot dangling for satisfaction, for peace. And the Lord just wants us to bite down on that and let it nourish us. And then it works, the virtues work themselves out as we hope in a God who has done this for us and is doing it in us.
And very pointed, right to the point, if we are recipients of divine mercy, not the judgment we deserve, how much more should we show mercy to one another's, one another? And so you write, showing mercy isn't merely getting things done, it's expressing God's kindness to someone with a name. That makes it personal, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And it's fashionable today to do merciful things and to pick out a cause, a just cause. And in my experience, sometimes that cause and that mercy is more self-serving than other-serving. It's kind of a notch in the belt. Mm-hmm. I'm part of this community. I'm part of this cause. And I wanted to reframe it and say, mercy has a face. You know, it's the neighbor who's going through a divorce. They both have a name and a story. And if I want to show mercy, I've got to get into the difficulty and the pain and the mess of that. You know, it's the person in the projects that we spend time with that needs not just a meal, but needs loving eyes. And a hand on the shoulder, maybe a 30-second prayer. You know, mercy is intensely personal. And we know that because the Lord Jesus is personal. He didn't just kind of, you know, throw some salvation tickets from heaven and say, jump on board. he disrobed himself of all that glory and came down and became a human being, became a helpless child, lived in relative, obscurity for 30 years, and then spent three years teaching and suffering and then dying in our place. I mean, this is, if anybody knows that mercy is for people, it's the Lord Jesus. He embraced so much humility and hardship for Peter and James and John and Ron and Jonathan. Mm. He knows mercy has a name.
Yes.
And he calls his sheep and they hear his voice, and he knows our name. Mercy, we get this from the Lord Jesus. It's so sweet. It's so touching. It's so real. It's so personal. So I wanted to just challenge a bit this kind of idea of using mercy and justice to feel good about yourself or to let's remember where this comes from and who it's for.
Purity in an age of self-expression. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. How is this related to the concept of inner purity? Or what is it? How is it you're approaching this particular one? Let me just go general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so purity has fallen on hard times also, and there are some good reasons for that. The purity culture, in which if you remain sexually pure before you get married, you're seen as good. If you make a mistake in this area, you're seen as bad and kind of get the scarlet letter in religious communities. And so the purity culture today has been criticized for its legalism and its inflexibility, and really particularly treating women in a disparaging and kind of utilitarian way. So I wanted to think more robustly about what purity is about. And there's kind of an inner and an outer purity. And what I just described would be like the outer purity. It's the keeping the moral rules, the sexual morals. Your conduct looks good on the outside, and therefore you're accepted. But there's also today an inner purity. Be true to myself. To their own self be true. You find your truth, a kind of allegiance to self, not to any outward standard of purity. And, of course, that becomes very subjective very quickly. The example I use in the book is of Ross Ulbricht, who started the dark web site, The Silk Road. And he is principally believed and studied philosophy in the autonomy of the self, and in the total freedom. And so he applied it to this business venture, the Silk Road. Of course, on this dark web, there was, human trafficking, gun sales, opportunities to hire, to kill people, certainly plenty of drugs, a whole host of things that are very bad for society, whether you're a Christian or not. And yet it was the outworking of this kind of libertarian, beholden to the self, total commitment to freedom of the individual. And so that inner purity, and he was consistent with that idea. I mean, he took it all the way to the mat, and he went in prison for it. It's obviously not good for society. So inner purity and outer purity, religious purity or secular purity, if you will, or individual purity, both have problems. And so as we think about what does it mean to be pure in heart, we need to find a better definition of purity.
Yes.
And I think what the Lord is driving at here is both purity of heart and purity of action. And the problem with that is that it's impossible to get a pure heart on your own. I mean, the sullied motives. You know, even some of our best actions, often we walk away wondering, did I make an impression? How did they see me?
Yes.
Was I notable? There's even a bit of pride attached to some of our best actions. And so pure heart is hard to come by. And so as we think about blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, the hope is seeing God. And in fact, these promises at the end, they're breaking in now. So I can see God. When I look at Christ, I see the knowledge of the glory of God shines in the face of Jesus Christ, the scriptures tell us. And when I look in his face and I trust his face and I trust who he is and what he's done, I see God and I am satisfied and I am cleansed and forgiven and given a pure standing before God. And then he continues to purify us,
right,
not just internally, but externally. So, yeah, I'm trying to deal with some of the broken views of purity and then get us to look at the Lord.
Good.
Who
I need to break in.
Yeah,
we could take this break. Look at the Lord. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify, just about 20 minutes, a little bit less than that. Our guest is Jonathan Dodson. The title of this book is Our Good Crisis, written before the pandemic, but it has applications to it. It's about overcoming moral chaos with the Beatitudes, eternal struggle. That we have two more Beatitudes that we want to deal with, the last two dealing with peace and persecution, but I just have to add something that's personal, my personal preference, that Jonathan points out that we can see God through nature, and he writes, nature announces his glory, which is the radiant sum of his perfect attributes. And then he has this quote from theologian Louis Burkhoff, and I've put asterisk next to it, not only underline it, but it's simple, but it's so rich. He describes God's immensity as, quote, that perfection of the divine being that transcends all spatial limitations. You need to think about that. You need to experience it in your mind, in your heart. That perfection of the divine being that transcends all spatial limitations. And then Jonathan writes, unfortunately, this doctrine is infrequently taught or discussed, and yet it is one of the most urgent in the age of the big me. So again, with 20 minutes left, there's so much more we need to talk about. That's why you need to get a copy of the book, Our Good Crisis, that has so much more in it, even when we talk about this long. Peacemaking in an Age of Outrage. Tell us a little bit, Jonathan, about the culture of fragility that we live in, and why and how is our culture so fragile?
Yes, so there, you know, we all like peacemaking as an ideal, but when it comes to the friction, rejection, difference of opinion, or offense, very, very often peacemaking goes out the door. And so I'm trying to assess why is it so hard in our time. And that there are two cultures, a culture of fragility and a culture of outrage. The culture of fragility is, it's interesting. There's a study done by Jonathan Haidt and Lukianoff, a psychologist, and it's called the coddling of the American mind, and they document this trend on campuses across the United States, but we're seeing it kind of globally and certainly on social media. And the trend is this: anything that I find offensive, any ideas that I find disagreeable, are potentially harmful. So I don't just brand them or categorize them as wrong, but as potentially harmful or personally doing personal violence to me. So example, there have been numerous cases where a professor is invited to speak at a university and then a student body or group protests and runs them off and they don't actually lecture. Or a email by a university president is taken out of context and then perhaps for racial reasons or personal reasons or whatever, in some cases, they have lost their job over the outrage. But the outrage comes from a place of fragility. And so basically, if there's any kind of teaching that I find incompatible with my own personal worldview, it's harmful. So that's puts us in this fragile state in which it's very hard to have conversations with people who oppose us. And of course, the sad thing is that this is what the liberal arts are for. This is why the university was created, so that you could have the mutual exchange of differing ideas and be sharpened in your mind and educated about the world we live in. But there's this radical, kind of fragile culture of harm. Safetyism is the term they give to it. At all costs, I want to be safe, and so I'm going to protect myself from anything that would challenge the self, that would challenge my own beliefs. So that's a culture of fragility. You can imagine that it's very hard to have a civil conversation with someone who's prone to withdraw and says that your ideas are harmful. On the other end, you have the culture of outrage, and the outrage is you don't withdraw, you just turn up the heat, you turn up the volume. And there's the vitriol, and there's hate speech, and there's, you know, and both the right and the left do both of these things. It's not partisan. And so, man, we want to be people of peace. We want to enjoy contentment and have a joyful, peaceful life. It's very difficult when you have these polarizing cultures and relationships to actually have peace.
Yes.
So I look at this at kind of a relationship level. Basically, when I thought about this beatitude, I thought to myself, who are the peacemakers in my life? You know, who are the models that I can look to that are peacemakers? A peacemaker is going to make peace, and in order to make peace, you have to work through conflict. And I had the hardest time in thinking of people that I would go, this person is a great peacemaker. They walk into conflict humbly. They listen to other person's point of view. They weigh it. They're thoughtful. Anyway, so I was personally challenged to be more like this. I had a difficult finding models of this. And yet Jesus says, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Well, the promise attached to this, as I thought about it, actually frees us to be, as Christians, the best peacemakers on the planet. Because as I walk into a relationship in which I might see it harmful or disagreeable, I'm not ultimately threatened by the person. I'm not ultimately threatened by an idea. And the reason is this. I'm a son of God. I'm a daughter of God. I'm the beloved. I am accepted, loved for who I am with all my flaws, with all my bad theology, with all of my issues. I am unquestionably loved. And so if I live into that, if I believe that, that frees me to walk into a conflict and be wrong. I don't need to prove that I'm right. I'm right with God. I don't need to be angry and to get you on my side. I can trust that that will happen in God's good timing with other people. That doesn't mean you back off your convictions. It doesn't mean you have, you know, healthy debate. But I don't have to be fragile, and I don't have to have outrage. I don't have to be angry. I don't have to withdraw, because I have a settled place of acceptance and worth, and I can walk into a conflict humbly and look to learn, as well as communicate what I believe to be right and be charitable. And both these ends of the fragility and outrage, there's not charity. You know, there's not love. There's not patience. And of all people on the planet, Christians should be exuding patience and charity and love, especially in conflict. We're the sons and daughters of God.
Yes.
What do we have to lose?
I want to jump back 1 second. Just when we were talking about seeing God in nature, I was thinking about during the first hour of the program, I could hear birds singing in the background. Wherever you're at, I could hear the birds singing. I wanted to comment on it, but I thought it would be too distracting. So I'm waiting until the end to distract a little bit. But nevertheless, it was like a nice, it was just had a nice feel to it, because I love to hear birds sing also, especially when I'm home and see experience God through nature. So in this particular one, you talk about Jesus's vision of peacemaking is shalom. You write that Jesus calls us to be peacemakers, which assumes the presence of conflict. He knew tension in relationships. is God's appointed grace for moral and spiritual change. Therefore, the solution to outrage is not to retreat to the enclave of victim where we console ourselves with the many wrongs done to us. That fragile world is as dangerous as it is inaccurate. Nor do we stand our ground inflexibly spewing hot takes, unwilling to enter into true reflection and dialogue. Rather, the path forward is to embrace adversity with meekness, humbly seeking change and peace. And I could read so much more, but let's, in closing the last 7 minutes or so we have, speak a little bit about persecution in an age of comfort.
Can I follow up your comment about the birds?
Oh, please. Oh, please.
So we are outside of Austin. We rented an Airbnb to get away from some of the... We live in a condo, and it's small quarters. We have 3 children, 2 teenagers, and a 9-year-old. And my wife had this great idea, let's get out into the country. So we came out to this house, and the birds you were hearing, where it's just... the area is called Dripping Springs. It's beautiful. And there's a red cardinal that visits every day, and there's two skunks that come out every morning. And it's been wonderful because it's been a place, like we talked about, you know, to in the chaos, in the headlines, in the tech, to slow down and create some space to listen to the Lord. And as I've gone for runs and walks and I've observed these beautiful creatures, it's interesting how unflustered they are.
Yes.
You know, they are little examples to me. And I was struck by the thought that, you know, birds don't bark, they sing.
Yes.
You know, there's the trees, very few trees weep. Many of them lift their arms in praise. It just, there's so much instruction from nature and from creation. And it's been a wonderful place to kind of push against the 24-hour news cycle, the anxiety of the changing headlines, and to just be still and know the Lord. And maybe, you know, I know I've shared love there between us for creation and for meeting the glory of the Lord around us. So perhaps that's an inspiration to some of the listeners this evening.
Yes, and my sister just bought this book on birds. So as we watch these birds in our backyard, we know what they're doing. And when I watched a robin, I would see the way robin would cock his head, and I thought that he was listening for, you know, the grubs and stuff in the ground. But mm-hmm. He doesn't cock his head to listen. He cocks his head because he's looking for one blade of grass to move. That's what he's looking for. Just one little bit of movement of grass, and he's got dinner, you know. So, well, we could go on and on. That would be another program. Say a little bit about persecution in an age of comfort. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Mm. Well, many of us, we think about persecution. We think of the persecuted church. We think of people lined up on the sandy shore in orange jumpsuits, you know, who are executed. We think of the Chinese underground church, pastors in chains, and that is all suffering and that is all persecution. However, there is a persecution in the West that is not physical, but emotional and verbal and spiritual. And in this beatitude, Jesus addresses those, the different types of, he does this rejoice, blessed are you when all kinds of men revile against you and say things falsely. So there's kind of a verbal persecution that can happen. And today there's it's not popular to be a conservative Christian, you know, to someone that believes in the Bible and the righteousness that we talked about earlier, the uniqueness of Christ. And so sometimes that brings some kind of verbal persecution. It may bring it through the cooler talk or the criticism in the headlines or, you know, friends at work who hold different worldviews. But it also can come in kind of this insidious kind of pretty persecution, and it, and that is in all the comfort that we have. We have air-conditioned cars. We have, you know, people deliver food to us. We wake up and change the climate in our homes. We have machines that do our dishes. I mean, we live in a culture of gratuitous comfort. And so anytime we brush up against inconvenience, like we're out of toilet paper, you know, whatever, becomes, you know, we can get bent out of shape. Is it any wonder that we're not willing to persevere or take the difficult stance in our society regarding the uniqueness of Jesus and his righteous teachings when we are buffeted by comfort all day long? So I'm trying to make the case in this chapter that, yes, there are physical persecutions in the world that perhaps are certainly not as intense as what we experience here in the United States, but there are other forms, and some of them are so seductive that we don't realize it. And perhaps we have refused the cost of discipleship in following Jesus, and therefore are losing out in a brighter witness, a deeper life, a source of contentment and joy that we just can't find when we live under the spell of a culture of comfort. And therefore, we're further from Jesus.
Yes.
So I'm trying to make the case there is persecution. Let's embrace it as we follow our Lord. We do have a Lord with scars. Let's follow him wherever he leads and be true to him and trust him with the results.
And of course, there's that that comes from Satan, and you alluded to that. And you're right, Satan has declared an attack on God's people, seeking to subvert faithfulness to Jesus through the ruse of distraction. Under his influence, we are tempted to compromise holiness for the thrills of popular culture. We would rather serve than be served. And Jesus uses, you write, three different terms to describe this persecution: revile, persecute, and speak falsely. The first, translated revile, means to find fault as a way of shaming, to demean. This form of persecution is emotional in nature and is intended to belittle. The second word, translated persecute, means to harass because of one's beliefs. It is used in the context of laying hands on a person, imprisonment, and murder. It is physical in nature. The third phrase, to speak all kinds of evil falsely, is clearly more verbal. And then let me read this last quote from your book. While we can't rule out physical persecution in the West, we usually face a persecution that is emotional and psychological. Cultural critic and Christian apologist Ken Myers said this suffering, quote, may be as serious for modern Christians as persecution and plagues were for the saints of earlier centuries. The challenge of following Jesus amidst comfort is just the tip of the iceberg. Convenience has an anesthetizing effect that leaves us unaware of less visible oppression. Our guest this evening has been Jonathan Dobson. The title is Our Good Crisis. And Jonathan, I didn't know you were away with your family now. And you came and spent 2 hours on this program.
Well, we're also doing some work. It's not all play, but
okay.
I have permission.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much, and I hope that we have an opportunity to do something together again in the future, and God bless you and your family during this time you have together.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being
You're
such
welcome.
A generous host.
I've You're welcome.
Enjoyed our time.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
There's so much to say. Let me just quote from part of the book. He writes, "The way into the mystical, inebriating love of Christ is not through moral perfection, but humble reflection. It is by acknowledging our need, not announcing our plenty, that we gain access to the Son. Isaiah said it well, quote, "But to this one I will look to him who is humble and contrite of spirit, and who trembles at my word," close quote. Will you tremble at Christ's holy character inscribed in these sayings? Will you reach out not ultimately for virtue, but for help? Then salvation will come and righteousness with it. Christ will answer our cry every time. I repeat it. Christ will answer our cry every time. His face does not cease to shine, nor his mercies tarnish. They are new every morning. Each beatitude inspires and challenges us at once. Together they beckon us to a future garden where loving will be like walking and righteousness falls like rain. Until then, we must see our sin and evil through the eyes of our suffering Savior, where the comfort of heaven overlaps the sufferings of death. Take heart and keep your eyes on Christ. Dig in and walk in his ways. Endure, for reward is coming. See Christ with the eyes of faith, and his glory will become visible to those around you. Droplets of his beauty will roll off of us, causing goodness to spring up around us. When we do this together, we nourish the world with Jesus' coherent and fruitful moral vision. When we're absorbed with Christ, the Spirit puts the future on display. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Once upon a dismal day, Bob's ice cream van looked gloomy and gray. Although he had big ambitions, his socials lacked creative vision.
That bad?
Maybe vamp it up a tad?
I have an idea.
Bob launched Canva and got into gear.
Create the video in the vampire theme and make it the funniest meme.
It went viral. Bob's business, a revival. Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at canva.com.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see rates and fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.